Frequently in science, the easiest questions to pose are the hardest to answer. Take consciousness, for example. What does it mean to be conscious? What processes in the brain make us aware of the world around us? Where does our self-awareness come from? Well, those questions have so stumped scientists that for centuries they have virtually ignored them. But now, with the help of philosophers, neuroscientists are tackling the problem of consciousness. And as NPR's Joe Palca reports, they're making some progress.
If scientists want to really understand human existence, they'll have to unravel the mystery of consciousness, why it is that our brains are aware of the sights and sounds around us. And at the moment, they've got a long way to go. Before you can study consciousness, you have to define it. That job has traditionally been left to philosophers like David Chalmers of the University of California at Santa Cruz. He's been at the center of a recent flurry of scientific inquiry into consciousness. By Chalmers' definition, consciousness is how the mind views the world.
You can think of it as, you know, the movie theater inside the mind, with pictures and sounds that you feel, and things like pains and itches, the feel of emotion, the quality of thought. Basically, all of the mental states that we have, which have some kind of subjective aspect to them, some kind of a subjective feel.
On one level, consciousness is simply being aware of the sounds in a Mozart symphony. Scientists know that when the music enters your ear, it causes the eardrum to vibrate, sending a signal to the cochlea, which sends one to the auditory nerve, which sends one to the brain. All that will happen whether you're conscious or not. But somehow, the brain has to become aware of the music, and that awareness is consciousness. But there's more to it than that. Our conscious experience of a Mozart symphony is richer, more complex, and emotional than merely the sounds entering our ears. One way to understand this better is to compare human and animal consciousness. Psychologist Irene Pepperberg at the University of Arizona is studying an African gray parrot named Alex, who certainly acts like he's conscious.
Okay, Alex. I'm going to give you a tray of different objects. We got red and blue balls and blocks. Okay, now look on the tray. Can you tell me how many blue block? How many blue block?
Two.
Okay, you're a good boy. Can you tell me how many rows block?
Four.
Four, good boy. That's a good birdie. Okay, you can have a nut.
Irene Pepperberg's parrot, Alex, is a remarkable and important individual in this world.
Daniel Dennett studies consciousness at Tufts University.
I have seen enough of what Alex, the parrot, can do to realize that he is not just a well-trained circus animal. He is not just doing this by rote memorization. It hasn't been just dinned into him. He makes remarkable transfers of knowledge and inferences. Alex is a pretty amazing parrot.
What's here?
Truck.
That's good boy, truck. Good parrot. How many?
Two.
That's right. Good boy.
Want a nut?
Well, you can have a nut. Go choose your own.
But Dennett doesn't think Alex has quite reached what he calls liftoff. Alex is certainly conscious in the sense that he hears and sees and can even answer simple questions. But Dennett says Alex is missing certain qualities typically associated with consciousness. He doesn't spontaneously engage in conversation, and he doesn't know he's a parrot. Self-awareness is, by some definitions, critical for consciousness. But then I wondered what Dennett would make of my 2-year-old son Sam and his pal Nathaniel.
What's that? Fish.
What's that?
Ambulance. Ambulance.
What color is the ambulance?
White.
White, that's right.
White.
Yeah, you're right.
That's a big bus.
It's not just paternal pride that convinces me Sam's more conscious than a parrot. He knows his colors and his trucks. But getting at his self-awareness, his sense of his own consciousness, isn't easy.
Now, one more question for you, Sam. Who are you? Who are you, Sam? Don't kick Nathaniel.
I think the case of small human infants is directly relevant here, because they, like other species, can't tell us, can't communicate with us in language. And when they become able to do this, they don't have any memories of those early periods. It's a catch-22. By the time they can tell us what it was like, if anything, they either it wasn't like anything or they can't remember.
And the catch-22 Dennett describes is the kind of problem that's made neuroscientists shy away from studying consciousness and kept it in the realm of philosophers like David Chalmers.
One of the great difficulties in this field, one of the things that makes consciousness such a puzzle, is that we don't have direct ways to measure each other's consciousness in the ways that we have to measure other things like temperature and mass and so on. Now, people say it would be a lot easier if we had some mythical device, the consciousness meter, to go and poke inside each other's heads and see what's going on in each other's consciousness. But, you know, we don't have such a thing. Consciousness seems to be essentially subjective and private, which raises huge difficulties about how it is that we're ever going to know what's going on.
But maybe not insurmountable difficulties. New imaging technologies give scientists the opportunity to peek inside a living human brain. And scientists are beginning to find clever ways to tackle consciousness. Caltech neuroscientist Christoph Koch is one of a small but growing group of researchers who feel it's time to address the question of how the brain makes sense out of the constant barrage of input from the senses.
From a neuroscientific point of view, consciousness was not on the map till, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago. It simply wasn't talked about. And, you know, people, you know, after they had several beers at conferences would talk about it. But, you know, the next day they'd say, okay, well, let's get serious. Let's, you know, I'm not going to worry about that. It's obviously a philosophical or metaphysical problem. And so this has been a very recent phenomenon, like say in the last 5 years, that now not just philosophers and psychologists, but neuroscientists, who I think ultimately will provide the answer, take this problem conscience seriously.
Koch says the only way to deal with large problems like consciousness is to break them down into smaller, more manageable chunks. So Koch is working mainly on visual consciousness, how the brain is aware of signals coming from the eyes. It turns out that scientists have recently identified a remarkable group of people who experience a bizarre visual phenomenon that says a lot about what it means to be conscious of what your eyes are telling you. Koch says the phenomenon is called blind sight.
So here you have patients, let's say, who have a stroke in the back part of the brain called the occipital lobe. Okay, let's say they've had a stroke or gunshot or something like that.
The occipital lobe is the part of the brain that does the most sophisticated processing of visual signals. Scientists have known for a long time that each side of the brain processes signals from half of the world in front of our eyes. So if the occipital lobe on one side of your brain is damaged, you would lose half your visual field. To these patients, everything on one side of the world looks blank, says Koch, as if their eyes were closed.
Now they go to the doctor, and the doctor moves his finger in that blind part, and the doctor asks him, do you see? Can you guess which direction my finger is going? And the patient says no, and the doctor insists, well, just guess. And the person says, well, I'm blind. Anyhow, so the patient is forced to guess, and then lo and behold, suddenly this patient, to his own surprise, discovers that his guesses turn out to be correct. So, for example, he can tell whether the doctor's fingers move to the left or to the right, up or down. So here you have what looks like a paradox that although they all claim that they're blind in this visual field, they can still do certain types of visual behaviors. Now, they can't read, they cannot do very sophisticated visual processing in their blind part, but they can do certain visual behaviors.
Koch says people with blind sight prove that people can perceive something without being conscious that they've done so. Finding exactly what's missing in people with blind sight should say a lot about what's essential for visual consciousness. Researchers in Koch's lab are now working on this. Koch has already formed a theory about how visual consciousness works.
Biology is very specific. There are very specific genes that mediate very specific traits, right? And we know, for example, there are very specific neurons in your brain that one neuron will only respond if it sees, you know, my mom's face from a particular profile. So similar, we believe it's that consciousness actually arises probably out of very specific set of neurons.
Other researchers say it's not specific neurons at all. Instead, they argue, consciousness is a property that emerges from the sheer number of nerve cells that are constantly active in the brain. It's the pattern of activity that's responsible for consciousness, not any specific group of nerves. But some believe the tools of science may never fully explain consciousness. They argue that the essence of consciousness, that quality that makes a Mozart symphony or a bright red rose more than just items that enter our senses, is beyond the reach of scientific inquiry. Philosopher David Chalmers says that neurobiologists may explain how we get to be conscious without explaining what consciousness is.
The real mystery is, in some sense, remaining untouched. That's what I call the hard problem, which is the problem of why is it that all these physical processes in the brain and all this complex functioning should give you a subjective inner life, a conscious experience at all? It may be that when it comes to consciousness and the theory of consciousness, we're going to push things back to a point where we aren't going to be able to explain it any further. There'll be certain fundamental facts about the connection between the mind and the brain, such as why is there consciousness in the first place, that we just have to take as primitive and unanswerable.
David Chalmers has got it exactly wrong. He is creating a problem where none really exists.
Daniel Dennett thinks David Chalmers and his notion of the hard problem of consciousness is making the same mistake philosophers made a century ago about life. They couldn't believe that a bunch of chemicals working together were enough to produce a living being, so they postulated a life force not of the physical world that made things go. This theory, known as vitalism, was quite popular at the turn of the century, says Dennett.
Then along came modern biology and showed that the various wonderful phenomena of life could all be explained in terms of the interaction of all of these wonderful little chemical machines. And gradually, the idea of vitalism has lost its persuasiveness. There are very few vitalists today. We pretty well understand that there is no hard problem of life. Well, I expect that there will turn out to be no hard problem of consciousness either.
Many researchers consider understanding consciousness to be one of the big questions of science, right up there with understanding how the universe formed or how life on Earth began. Even if consciousness never fully yields to scientific inquiry, the search for answers should still tell us plenty about the secret inner life of the mind. This is Joe Palca.